Hello, you're listening to the Wellspring Podcast, dedicated to quenching your thirst for bygone days. I'm Gwen Toonman, an author digging into the past for details that will form the bedrock of my novels and short stories. This very special episode was recorded at Lynn House Museum in Whitby, Ontario, where I was joined by Tom Taylor, historical fiction author and War of 1812 aficionado. Tom has had a varied career. He's been a television host and producer, a longtime entrepreneur and director, a company president, and now an award-winning writer. In another century, he graduated from York University in history, and as a younger man, he served in the 7th Toronto Artillery Regiment. He is the author of such novels as Brock's Agent, Brock's Railroad, Brock's Traitor, and Brock's Assassin. Also joining us is Monica Effenberger, curator of the Lynn House Museum. Lynn House Museum is the perfect backdrop to a discussion about the War of 1812. As we'll hear from Tom and Monica, the Lynn family often hosted General Isaac Brock and played a role of importance in the War of 1812. I opened our discussion by first asking Tom how he made the leap from historian to historical fiction writer.
That's a good question. You know, historians interpret history. There is no truth in that sense. We all interpret, whether on a societal level, historians interpret what they read and what they see and what they understand. And on a personal level, if, you know, the old story, if we all saw an accident happen, we'd all have our own view. We'd speak the truth for us and as best we could. So historians like to purport to tell the truth. This is our, you know, the history of Pickett, you know, Holland. This is the history of Holland in the Second World War. The history, as if it's the truth. But it's really kind of a lie in a way, because it's an interpretation as much as anything else. So I've said to you before, I like to call historical fiction a lie that tells a truth, because what I do now is I tell a story about the War of 1812, but I try to capture the spirit of the thing and not just the facts. And often I raise this example about Isaac Brock. And so here's the difference between history and historical fiction. Brock was in Canada approximately 10, 12 years. He died, unfortunately, on October 13th at about 5, 6, maybe 7 in the morning at the Battle of Queenston Heights in 1812. This book culminates with that great battle. So history records he was in Canada all that time, and he never had an affair. There's no documentation of him ever having an affair with any woman. But we know he had lots of female friends. And, I mean, here he is. He's a good-looking guy. He loved parties. He loved to dance. The night before his death, in fact, he had a party at his home in Niagara-on-the-Lake, which was Newark at the time. He cut the party short because there was a report that something fishy was going on down the river at Queenston. So in my novel, in Brock's Agent, Brock has a sleepover. Now, I don't, you know, it's this. I'm Canadian. We're sort of British. Yeah. And I always, you know, it's silly. My mom was alive when I was writing this thing. And as a writer, I was thinking, geez, my mom's going to read this thing. I better keep, he'll have a sleepover and I'll let the reader decide what happens, right? I'm not telling about it. But I was on stage with a professor from Brock, and we were at Fort York, maybe 100 people in the audience, and he said, well, this book, he has Brock as I think he called him a philanderer. There's one scene, I mean, come on. And there's no evidence of this ever happening. And so I asked the moderator, can I say something? I had already had my say. And then he was speaking about his book and why Brock charged up Queenston Heights. It wasn't a bad book, actually. But he was a history professor. So there had to be written evidence. But I've always maintained Brock was a gentleman. He's not going to tell tales about who he's sleeping with or not. It would be unthinkable for him to do that. So this guy sits down after trashing my book, the moderator who wanted controversy. So I stood up and I said, okay, he's 43 years old, and that's when he died. So he was in his 30s, a great time. Yeah. Head of the province, he was known as president of the executive council. So, I mean, he's Major General Isaac Brock to us, but often people referred to him back then as the president. Loves parties, good-looking guy. How many in here think that Isaac Brock was celibate for his 10, 12 years in the Canadas? Put up your hands. Okay, nobody put up their hand. I said, how many of you think he might have had an affair? Everybody put up their hands. Everybody. So I looked at this guy and I said, now that's the difference between historical fiction and history. Look, all the facts in here, the historical facts, are accurate. Dates of the battle, the time he died, they're not quite sure the exact time he died. He's wearing a brigadier's jacket, not his major general's jacket. That's in the novel. I mean, it's about 4 a.m. when he gets woken. It's dark in his room. He just reaches out, grabs a jacket. It's a brigadier's jacket. Gets on his horse, rides to Queenston Heights along the Niagara Parkway. I don't know if you've driven down. It's quite beautiful down there. Yeah. So if you imagine Isaac, off he goes. This professor, just to end this little story, afterwards, there was another guy on the panel as well, an archaeologist who was doing digs at the fort. So we were asked to stay afterwards to sign books and talk to people. This guy got up and he stormed out of the room, and I've never heard from him again or seen him anywhere. His books are out there, but he was quite upset, I think, to be kind of shown up by this lower life historical fiction guy, you know. But the problem with history is if the bunch of us ran across the street in the pouring rain, and if it wasn't documented that by the time we got there we were wet, well, history wouldn't record that any of the raindrops hit us. They'd assume, well, we managed to dodge every raindrop. I mean, there's certain things in history that are silly. And as a graduate of York, you know, being a guy that was kind of cantankerous a little bit as a student, you know, I was always looking for where history didn't work as much as where it worked. I respect what they do. It's not easy. It's a lot of work. I have an 1812 newspaper from Alexandria in the States. And I was researching the cost to retrieve a slave. And I was told it was originally $5. If you look in the history books, they'll tell you $5. Some were 10. Well, there's one for 20 in there, you and I saw. And then Gwen and I found one on the front page for $100 to retrieve a slave. So, you know, there was a wide breadth. So, you know, I respect that historians take a lot of time to get this right. By the same token, theirs is an interpretation of the past, and so is mine. Not every view of the past is an historical one. So I would put it to you briefly that there's no history in the Toronto Star, because every view of the past is not an historical one. So I'll give you a quick example. Brock rode that distance between Newark and Queenston Heights 1,000 times. Do we care? No. We care about one time. The morning of October 13th, 1812. That's when we care about it. Now, the press probably reported General Brock's on the move. Every morning, all his movements were tracked, unless he was keeping them secret. Mm-hmm. And the press would report on what he was up to. General Brock's moving to York, because he was at Fort York a great deal. Even in your own life, maybe as young women, you went to many dances, and you met different men. 99% of them didn't matter. But there was that one guy you met, that one time at the dance or a dinner with your parents or somewhere, and that's when you fell in love. Now that's an important historical time for you. So history works on the societal level, and it works on the person. The same principles laid down by, you know, Kierkegaard and Hegel and all these great philosophers. If they don't work on a personal level, they're not going to work on the societal level. So they got to work on both. So if you want to know, to get back to my long-winded answer to your question, why I moved from one or how I did it, well, that's how I did it. I wanted to bring a Canadian hero. I wanted to write about a Canadian hero. And I knew he had to be fictional because I wasn't writing about Gordie Howe and Wayne Gretzky and those heroes. I wanted to write about, the Americans have lots of them, and the British have James Bond and all those guys. Why can't we have a hero? We had good guys, great guys.
I think that's kind of a nice segue to ask if there is a section of the book that you would like to share with us.
I can do that. Just to give you a sense of voice, there's actually two little sections. So this is from the second novel. This is the one I've been referring to. First one was Brock's Agent, and that's the introduction to young Jonathan Westlake, the hero, Upper Canada's first secret agent in the War of 1812. He has some great adventures in this one. So Niagara Falls, 1812. Luther Johnson ran for his life. He tilted his head to listen as the sound of dogs merged with the strange rumble of constant thunder. He urged on his feet with his older brother beside him, pounding the trail to freedom, or at least that was their plan. From Virginia to the edge of the Niagara River, with help at stops along the road, they had outsmarted the slave catchers. But he knew that the catchers' two dogs, once unleashed, could quickly close the gap. Puzzled how rain could be falling from a blue sky, Luther turned one palm up while he ran. A wet wind gusted out of the west, soaking his blue shirt and torn gray pants so that they clung to his skin. The trees all around him bent and dripped, heavy with moisture. He bolted past his brother, shot out of the forest, and hauled himself up stiffly to attention, exactly 3 paces from a rocky precipice. The young man gazed at a spectacle. His eyes told him were real, but his mind couldn't believe. He swallowed hard, gasping for air, and jerked out an arm to stop Hector from charging onward. No high waves or big splashes beat against the shore. In fact, to Luther, it didn't look like real water, just a rumble of foam and sheer power, white and yellow, gushing over and down the cliff before him. "Can you fly? 'Cause I ain't jumping," Hector shouted to him, jabbing his finger at the Great Falls. "We took a wrong turn, or we didn't turn when we was supposed to. I don't know which." Luther huffed and shook his head. It didn't matter why they were pressed right up against the falls. His only concern now was what to do next. To travel downstream meant confronting yet more cliffs. He kneeled to the ground, hands on hips, retching with fear. His nostrils flared, taking in the scent of fresh water. He rocked backward and licked his lips, tasting the spray. "If the catchers are close and those dogs latch onto us, we'll have no choice." Hector yelled, lungs heaving. "We gotta keep running upstream, straight along them rocks." He stood 4 feet away, but Luther could barely hear his brother's words above the roar of the water. Almost out of his teens and only a year senior, Hector would usually decide what to do for both of them. At 6 foot tall, he was somewhat bigger and stronger than Luther, but the younger man suspected that when it came to making decisions, his own judgment surpassed his older brother's. "No choice to what? Jump?" Luther hollered. "We got one mighty whipping coming if the catchers do grab us. Then it's back to slaving, so start running." Hector pointed to his left, toward rocks, bathed in spray. Luther leapt from rock to rock, his bare toes only inches from the ledge that dropped more than 100 feet. Soon he was heading upstream around a bend, the surging water right beside him. For a time, both the catchers and the dogs were forgotten. For a time. So this is like the old Dashiell Hammett phrase. When you introduce a gun in Act 1, by Act 3, gotta go off. So we've introduced Niagara Falls in Act 1, in Act 3. Well, I'll leave it to you to decide what's going to happen. Over My Shoulder is kind of a special place in the world of 1812 because this is the hotel that the British retreated through, and soldiers ransacked the place. But before they got there, the officers had crossed the Don River and, you know, destroyed the bridge. And the Americans, it wasn't so easy to cross. I mean, the Blue Viaduct wasn't there. You know, no bridge, you don't cross. And then if you try to cross, well, the British are on this side taking pot shots at you while you're in the water, right? So they kind of stopped at the Don River, deserting the populace of Toronto and leaving them to the militia. There were two great bars at the time, two great hotels. One was the Jordan Hotel in Toronto, in York, which was known to have savory characters around there. Maybe American spies, maybe, you know, people who weren't American spies but weren't full-out British patriots either. So the Jordan was kind of mixed. The Lind House, as far as I can understand and what I've read, was always British, was always supportive of the British. They made money from the British. They worked with the British, and the British worked with the Lind House. So I can't read you too much of it because it's right at the end of the story. But I will say that you'll recognize this because you just went on the tour. So this is the British Army retreating to the Lind House. The two-story Lind Inn and Tavern loomed ahead as Westlake approached it on horseback. He had risen before first light, and after a small breakfast, ridden off at dawn. A couple of York militiamen challenged his arrival at the British perimeter, but he had no problem getting through. Entering the inn, he knocked on the door of an upstairs room. Major Nellis is his boss. "Enter," Major Nellis called out from within. Westlake opened the door and peered inside to see Nellis working in shirt sleeves, a quill in his hand poised over a sheaf of papers spread out on the table. "Good morning, Lieutenant." Nellis gestured to a chair across from him. "How is your mother today?" "Considering the circumstances, she's still in York." "She's doing rather well, sir." "And Miss Dunbar," this is another one. Westlake glanced down. "We'll see her shortly. Take a look through these names." He handed Westlake several sheets of papers that listed names and addresses. At the top of the first page, the heading read, "Those giving their parole." These men who, for their freedom, promised not to fight until they were exchanged for American prisoners held by the British. Westlake knew some of the men listed, mostly men he had not seen anywhere on the day of battle. Strange how a man from Markham, too ill to fight for us on the day of the battle, could walk more than 15 miles into York to sign his parole and then travel another 15 miles back home, Nellis said. So what men did to get out of fighting was they just said they were sick. "I can't do it. I'm sick today. I can't go." The British didn't look too favorably on that. And it wasn't just militiamen that did that. Regular soldiers did that in line of battle. "Oh, God, just not feeling well. Can't go today. Sorry, guys." So there could be reprimands. The one thing I would tell you is Brock's Railroad is a story about freedom. And in the terms of the time, the Colored Company, a group of 36 to 38 black slaves, former slaves, escaped slaves, fought beside the British at the Battle of Queenston Heights on the edge of the 41st Regiment, British Regiment. There's not a single report of them coming down with stomach flu on the day of the battle. They all went to fight. They all performed admirably. And, of course, they had really good reason. If they lost, where were they going? Back home.
So, Tom, you gave us some really nice broad brushstrokes of the War of 1812 and some of the things that were happening, you know, even just that experience of, you know, what would have happened if the men were trying to cross the Don River, the risks there. So that kind of takes my mind to you, Monica. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, If you could give us a clear picture of what the Lynn family role was, what Jabez was doing, the place of the house in that history of the War of 1812.
As Tom has mentioned, the house was a tavern and an inn. So soldiers came throughout the War of 1812, really, and they came here for somewhere to sleep. And oftentimes that meant they were sleeping on the floor because there wasn't always room enough for everyone to sleep in the house. And sometimes they even brought their wives and their families with them. And they also came for refreshments, for something to eat, something to drink on their way to go elsewhere. So it was a pretty important place during the War of 1812 for that kind of spot to stop on your way throughout place in the war. And also, along with that, Jabez Lind also kept government supplies in case officers like General Brock came to the house to get something that they would have needed for battle, or sometimes it meant there would be a doctor there to take care of wounded soldiers throughout the war. So definitely an important place for the war.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you stand in that house, mm-hmm. you're standing where General Brock stood. I mean, he went through that house, mm-hmm. not just Major General Shafe. There's Drummond.
Yep.
If you're an 1812er, you know who Drummond is. Mm-hmm. You know who all these characters are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our history isn't like some, it happened way back then. No, it's right there.
Exactly.
Monica, are there stories connected to the house about that particular event that Tom wrote about in Brock's Traitor, where General Shafe was retreating?
Yes.
And there were people coming?
Yes, there was. So that was one of the instances where we did have soldiers coming in to the house to get wounded, to get medical treatment from Dr. Lee and Powell, who were the ones giving the treatment. So a lot of wounded came, but like Tom mentions in the book, there was a lot of ransacking at that point in the house, because there wasn't really any officers with them. So they didn't have that person in power saying, okay, we can't just go and ransack people's property. And it even went a little bit further with actually a gold necklace being stolen from Mrs. Lind while she was sleeping. So it was stolen right off of her neck.
But think about how shabby Shafe controlled his troops. So the officers get there. I believe they stayed overnight. I think Shafe slept in there. And then they move on and don't leave an officer behind to keep control. They just say, you know, I'll let the soldiers do what they will. Recently, his great-great-granddaughter has come back to Canada to try and rebuild his reputation, because he's not looked upon as a great character. For stuff like that. I mean, not that he did bad things, but he just neglected to do some good things that would have been very easy for him to do.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I read, too, that some of the retreating soldiers took big hogsheads of whiskey.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or remember whiskey.
Probably be whiskey.
And there was like a great overcoat, and he sought compensation for that.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was 18 gallons at this point the Lynns had in their possession, and they were actually told by Dr. Lee and Powell to keep it for further wounded coming from York. But with the military men, they came and they just drank it all. So there wasn't any left for the wounded, and he did seek compensation. He estimated his damages at about 83 pounds. And he had to write a number of letters to the government just to get compensated for that loss. And in the end, he only got about 68 pounds of it back in about 1816.
Well, that's it for episode 1 of Tom Taylor, Monica Effenberg, and our discussion of Isaac Brock and the War of 1812. Join us for episode 2 when we continue our conversation.
And I think the method for a duel is to slap him in the face or something. And Brock said, sure, we can have a duel if that's what you want. And everybody, this guy was a sharpshooter.
If you'd enjoy the vintage photography and illustrations associated with this post and podcast, please visit gwentuman.com. That's GWENTUIMAN.com. And search Tom Taylor. While you're there, please leave a comment or a question. Share the article on your social media. Thanks for joining me. I'm so glad you're here. Stay inspired, keep smiling, and we'll chat again soon.